So if I find I'm getting too excited by life, I find it goes into my head and I'm really out there. They say, come back to the center. So I walk. I try to walk. You know, I don't have a complicated life. I have a very simple life, so I'm part lucky. So the more complicated it is, the more you get pulled out. But center staying is terribly important. You know, to stay centered. I mean, that's a commonality. So if you find that in your spiritual life you're just getting so distracted that you're just getting reactive, then for goodness sakes, go to Algonquin Park or go to a park or lock yourself in the toilet or do something. Just to bring your senses back, you know, to bring your composure back. Because when the mind becomes reactive, when it's just anything, you know, anything gets you angry, or anything gets you jittery, that means your heart is in a very, not in a good state. It's exhausted. We all have that, don't we? I get too overburdened by work or responsibility, and I just get reactive. The heart's saying, hey, I need a rest. And that's when sense restraint has been lost, either by too much work, too much responsibility, or whatever it is. And those are the signs. If we have some centering, right? If we have some centering, and then we begin to react, and we see that reaction, and we're mindful of it, and we don't react, then we begin to practice purification. We're able to be in more and more complex situations, and watch the reactions and not react, watch the tendency to react, but not buy into it, and our heart becomes stronger and stronger. You know, so someone like Ajahn Chah or His Holiness Dalai Lama or some of these great beings like Nelson Mandela, they can handle incredible things, can't they? They can be incredibly pressurized situations, and they can be quite with it, and that's very admirable. But some of us can't. You know, some of us don't have those capacities, some of us do. So in one hand, life can be a kind of time for developing strength and becoming a stronger person in more complex situations, in challenging situations, or it can be very overwhelming. You know, it depends, really. It depends on where you're at. The main thing is being aware of stream of consciousness, really being aware of that, and then having a form, having a structure which is like a vehicle, a mirror, a set of mirrors that you can give up to. And then you just ride along. See what happens. One day you're angry, one day you're not. And just kind of ride along, see what happens. And what was the joke in Tricycle? Mahayana, Hinayana, Vajrayana, all vehicles will be towed away. So, any questions or comments around that? Yes?
One thing that I've noticed from time to time is that I get into a negative state and I'm not really very aware of where it's coming from how it arose. What's the most skillful way of doing that?
Well, move away from the narrative. Move away from the thought. Move to the breath. Just the fact that you can notice the narrative and know that it's a negative state of mind is a big step. And just the fact that you can know the thoughts and then not pursue the thoughts is a big step. So a lot of people don't even take that step. They kind of know the mood is there, but they keep thinking through the mood. You know, so like depression. Yeah, I feel depressed. Yeah, I really feel depressed. I just go back to sleep, feel really depressed. You know, so there's a knowing of the depression, but then there's also just the thinking, depressed thoughts. So that kind of awakening, this is wrong thought. This is depressed thought. That is a vitality of the mind and a kind of strength of mind. And then if you have the presence to actually say, well, so what is this mood like, really? What is it really like to feel depressed? And then you bring this kind of... I've been using a kind of yin-yang model. You have the yang part is the vitality of investigation. And the yin part is the acceptance. Or the receptivity. Because if you... If you have vitality with aversion or an agenda or trying to get rid of it, you're not going to be free. But if you just have acceptance without the vitality, you're going to get swamped by it. So practice, moment by moment practice, has this kind of vitality of investigation and softness of acceptance. That's where the calm comes in. So my question is, okay, so what's it really like to feel ticked off? What is it really like to feel it? You know, so you're really going to it, but you're not with the storyline. Now, if you don't have that kind of vitality and the mood is just kind of encroaching on the mind, then you need to get out of the place. So if a person, like if in the monastery someone's, you know, we're on retreat, say. Let's say we're doing a long retreat, doing a 3-month retreat, and someone's just getting more and more depressed. Right? I'll just go for a long walk with them. I'll say, let's go for a 3-hour walk. And I'll make sure they walk fast. And I'll just help them to get more energy going, because they just don't have the yang part to investigate. They're overwhelmed by it. So sometimes you need to do kind of, something. Or in a monastery, if someone is, like in monastic life, we don't subscribe to the idea that you just have to face everything all the time. So let's say a monk is really having a lot of troubles with the abbot, and is just so caught up with projections around the abbot. We'll just switch abbots, send him off. Not send the abbot off. The abbot would like it. You know, send him off to another monastery, and we know it'll start again. We know darn well, you know, you don't get away with anything, but at least the person will feel refreshed, and then they have another chance to watch that projecting mechanism going on, and the blaming and so on. So sometimes, you know, with some moods, you need to do kind of extreme things, but ideally, you have this yin yang balance, and so that's why I like to use the word receptivity. Really, really be receptive to life and yet have that yang strength of, well, what's it really like? And that's what we're trying to, like samadhi has got, maybe has to have that. Like if you're looking at the breath and you're just too yang, you're just trying to control it, you get a headache. You get too willful. But if you're too kind of too yin and too receptive, you're just kind of waffle, spaced out kind of feeling. If you have both going, that's what you try to develop meditation, that kind of samadhi power of direct looking but receptive, and then that gives you the power in ordinary life. You know what that mind is like, and then you start to introduce that in committee meetings and cooking veggies or whatever, you know, whatever you're doing in life. But some of the moods are so powerful that you just keep working at them, keep working at them.
Trying to get that balance happening.
Yep. And keep seeing how the mood goes into thought, how memory triggers off the mood. Especially memory works that way a lot. You get a memory, and that triggers the mood triggers the thoughts trigger the memory, those type of memories start to come up, those memories trigger the mood, that mood triggers the thoughts, those thoughts, you know, it's just... You know, and memory is important, so you tend to believe the memory, you tend to believe the perception. So if I feel I've been done by someone in my life, you know, and my childhood's not been good, maybe it has been rotten. I have a great childhood, but let's say if I felt that, and I just, each time it came up, and then I dwelt on it, and then that memory created more sense of me having, you know, it just would be endless, and I'd have to just cut it somewhere. Yep. Ad nauseum, and it never ends. And that's where you have to see, you know, you have to really cut the memory and really know the mood in the present moment. That's awareness of the present moment. Cittanupassana, third foundation of mindfulness, is really, what is this mood like? I know the memory, I've seen that a million times. But the tendency is to be kind of lazy, not attentive, and the mind kind of waffles in those states and just feeds itself. So that's not, you know, that's not rejecting the memory. It's just knowing how memory conditions mood, you know, knowing that whole paticca-sama, that kind of dependently originated cycle. Yes? Nalini. Nalini 1 and Nalini 2. No. We have two Nalinis there.
The worst one.
No.
Attend your talk to the people with HIV.
Mm-hmm.
What was the focus of that?
Love, heart, non-hatred, non, you know, I talked a lot about remorse and because I had been talking with people earlier, there's a lot of, you know, kind of anger and self-hatred and hatred of others. There's a lot of that energy, someone was saying to me. So I talked just a lot about how to open the heart, how to keep it open, look, you know, get out of the storylines, go to the heart chakra, that kind of stuff. Nice, very nice, yeah.
Going back to your earlier comment that the response that you gave to the gentleman there about the vitality of family acceptance.
Yeah.
And in that inner technology, where is the place of invoking the higher power within you?
Well, I think the higher power within you is
form of prayer.
Well, I
when
think
you're sort of in that balance and when I'm losing balance, how would you invoke prayer in your
life? Well, it depends what you mean by prayer.
Is it invoking your higher self?
Well, in the way I operate, I have tremendous trust in awareness. And I know that awareness is conjoined with that which is most profound. So in Buddhism, we say mindfulness is the path to the deathless. So mindfulness is the link. It is and it isn't the deathless. It's the path to the deathless, but somehow it has to be conjoined with that, whatever the deathless is. So the more I practice, the more faith and trust I have that that's what's operating. Awareness operates, not me doing it. And if it's me trying to control it, then that's not the receptivity. So in the receptivity, there's a lot of faith. There's a lot of confidence, there's a lot of trust in that kind of awareness. And that's, for me, what invokes the deepest parts of the spiritual life. So it's not dualistic in that sense, but it's also not me in a selfish way trying to become something. So there is a quality of faith and waiting in that.
So where is the doership there, really?
The doership is in the investigation. In the discrimination, in the watching moment by moment, but without an agenda. And that's very hard, without desire to get or get rid of. So there's still attentiveness to the way things are, but with this receptive quality.
So, and you don't have to answer me, I'm just trying to understand it. Because for me, what works is invoking my own personal image of what I see as my higher power.
Okay.
And that image, I guess, is synonymous with what you're calling awareness.
Probably. Should be, yeah.
Are we on the same wavelength?
Yeah. Because that's where your faith and trust arises, right?
Right.
When you bring that image, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
When I bring that image, everything kind of dissolves.
Okay, yeah. And I use the more psychological language.
Which is awareness.
Awareness and receptivity.
Correct.
Those things, yeah.
Okay. I was semantic.
But important, yeah, important. And if it's like...
That's what I was saying in terms of invoking your higher power.
Right.
And I was trying to understand how you kind of do it.
I do it through that.
You do it through awareness.
Yeah. And awareness is, you know, over the years of contemplation, awareness and non-desire and the deathless have become more and more profound.
Correct. So then when you mention the word awareness, does an image come up to you?
No.
Does a sensation come up to you?
Stillness.
A stillness.
Mm.
That's a sensation.
Okay.
I'm just...
Yeah, fine. Yeah, okay. It's still knowing.
It's an inner mental, emotional, spiritual stillness.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
So it could be connected with a body sensation too, if you told us.
Yeah, both the mind and body are relaxed and still and attentive. Yeah.
Correct. And that's totally being aware and now.
Yeah. And the reason I say the investigative part is because of the tendency just to sort of go off into thought, so there's a brightness there too. There's a centeredness, a brightness.
Yeah, that's the vitality.
That's the vitality part, yeah. Yeah.
And the acceptance of the
Yeah. Yeah? Okay. Yes?
I was appreciating what you said about the role of thinking of guilt and self-hatred, and about coming to remorse. And I was wondering if there would be a question or a focus that you could suggest if one would, I guess, first of all, be aware of being in that place of guilt or self-hatred, and how to make that shift to a more useful
Well, if you take that same theme of positive to the negative, can you notice times where you encourage yourself in a kind way? In other words, when you say you're all right. Can you notice that? If you can't, a lot of people can't even notice that. If you can't notice that, can you notice the heart which encourages a child? All right? Any place where you can notice when the heart has a kind of encouraging, loving, kind quality. What does that feel like? Get a hold of that feeling. Okay? And that might be when you're okay with yourself, or when you're okay with nature, or you're okay with a child. But there's a kind of okayness about it. The heart feels at ease and good, and you know, that kind of feeling. And we have it, right? And I say, oh, that's what that feels like. And then when the guilt comes up, the more you notice that sense of ease and well-being, then that will be a kind of mirror to the guilt. So then when the guilt comes up, it's a contraction of the heart. It goes into thought, it's up here, and the heart feels contracted, right? And you might not notice it so obviously, but there'll be certain kinds of thoughts, right, as opposed to, oh, nice child, or beautiful river, whatever it is. So try to, first of all, touch those places of ease in yourself. You do it through meditation, one does it by canoeing, one does it by making a meal for someone and being happy and giving a meal, you know, generosity. So there's many ways we touch that. And then really recognize that. Ah, this is well-being. Well-being feels this way. Ease of being feels this way. And then listen to thoughts, really listen to your thoughts, learn to listen to your thoughts, and then you'll tend to notice its opposite, which is like guilt, right? And then when you notice the guilt, a guilt thought, notice the patterns of thinking. Try to notice what kind of thoughts those are, as a kind of a mindset, as opposed to the particulars that you're guilty about, you're feeling guilty about. So the object of one's guilt or the memory of one's guilt doesn't matter. And this is very important, because if I just focus on the subject of my guilt or the object of my guilt, then I'll just believe that. And what you're trying to do is get underneath the particulars to the general feeling of guilt, the whole mindset, the thoughts, okay? Then having got a kind of a hold of that feeling of guilt and what that feels like and what the mood feels like, then do things like, this is what it feels like to feel guilty. Make it really conscious. Guilt feels this way. Try to be aware of the body in that. Then do things like make it ridiculous. Think, you know, I'm guilty. All the world's problems are because of me. It was me that did it. And make it completely absurd. Really play with it. Get to know it inside out, you know, because this is your teacher. And so you just know guilt inside out, because it'll come up, and you'll know its opposite. And then make suggestions around guilt. Like if it's a very strong thing, make suggestions in your heart. Say, yeah, but I still love you. You know, it's just things like that. And which isn't to be smarmy or dismissive, but you're really going against the habit of mind to believe that as a kind of, you know, kind of reality. And sometimes it really seems believable. You know, you're really kind of, and there might have been something I did, you know, 20 years ago, which was really awful. It might be true, but, and I can say, well, I'm not doing it right now. Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. And somebody else will tell you, are you doing it now? No, of course not. Well, what's the problem? It's that lovely story from, I tell it lots of times. We were in London, in Hampstead. And a woman phoned up Ajahn Sumedho and said, I have to see you. Didn't know who she was. What is it? I have to see you quick. Okay, yep, come. Came to the Vihara. I said, I'm a terrible person. He said, well, what's the problem? What have you done? And she said, well, my daughter gave birth to a child. And when I held the child in my arms, this thought came up. I want to poke the child's eyes out. And she gave the child back to the mom and ran for it. Now this had happened like a few months before. I said, I'm a terrible person. And Ajahn Sumedho said, did you do it? She said, of course not. He said, so what's the problem? And it was classic. You know, it's just a weird thought in the mind came through. And she held on to it as a self. Yeah? And she went on and on. I mean, that was really weird. But even if, you know, even if she did it, and it was 20 years later, how's the guilt going to help? You know, if she kept doing it, then you're going to say, okay, feel guilty. So it's not like condoning, you know, you got to pay your dues. But is, you know, there's a difference between remorse and guilt, yeah. But all these things, get to know them. Really get to know them inside out. Yeah?
You used the word investigation, and I was thinking of the word path right away, and I was wondering if it helps to know why, and go back in our past to see why we feel guilty or why we feel angry or all these things.
It can help, yeah. But sometimes you don't have access to that. Sometimes you do. But sometimes, all you know, it depends. Sometimes you just can kind of go and kind of dig it up too much. You know, like guilt comes up, and you know it's guilt, or you know it's fear, and then you keep dwelling on it. Why am I feeling guilty? I'm so guilty. Rather than say, oh, this is just guilt. Sometimes you can really shift away from something without making it a problem. But sometimes, you know, some analysis is helpful. So it's neither yay or nay. It's neither black nor white. So what I would recommend is, does one just dwell on it like a loose tooth? Well, there I am. I'm feeling guilty again. Why am I feeling so guilty? Gosh, and what have I done? Rather than guilt feels this way. You open the mind rather than... Because there is that tendency to always analyze and dwell on. But sometimes, you know, the mind is so repressed with things, memories need to be made conscious. You know, where therapy is very helpful. So I generally think if you know the mood as it is, and you can recognize it as a mood, then you're practicing the four foundations of mindfulness. And you cannot perpetuate it with thought, then you're right with it. Yeah?
So would it go away?
Yeah. Yeah, it'll go away. It might come back, but that's all right. It's just memory. You know, so quite often we make too much of things. You know, like, you know, you haven't felt this thing for a while, for 2 months or whatever. It comes, oh, there it is again. There's that feeling again. That's something you're adding to it. It's, oh, there's that feeling again. It feels this way. Relax with it rather than, oh, no, I've lost it again. I've lost the plot. My gosh, I thought I was finished with that. Well, there it goes again. And the whole palaver begins again. So it does take a kind of determination. Say, oh, okay, there it is again. I know how to work with that one. rather, oh no. And it's just steady, 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 kind of training the mind, training the mind.
Just so that I understand that guilt doesn't help. If anything, it actually reinforces the negative pattern. Whereas remorse is transformative. There's an opportunity for change. So I get a sense from listening to you of the conversation is that if you add to guilt awareness and acceptance, that it can be transmuted into remorse.
Yeah.
If you hold guilt in the light of awareness and acceptance and have that sense that I'm not my emotions, I'm not my thoughts, I'm not my behavior, I'm actually a witness of these, which is a yogic idea, and I'm sure very similar with this idea.
Yeah.
The higher source, then you have options available to you. You can transmute it into something more usable, you can play with it, you can work with it, you can learn from it.
Yeah, it's objective. You're no longer the subject. Exactly. Yeah.
Whereas, this is what I'm getting at now.
Yeah. So the thoughts of self hatred and guilt are always very me. Whereas
you get a self out of it, yet your true self is actually a witness of all of that.
I call it the psychological self. You know, that kind of temporary thing which is created from delusion. There was a person on this in this wedding who had to perform, and the performance, the person was nervous, and the performance didn't come off very well. And the self-disparagement this person went into, my God, you thought, you know, the person had just committed genocide or something. Just went on and on and on and on. You know, and I was thinking, that's just selfish. Isn't it? It's self-consumed. And the joy of the whole thing was blocked by, I blew it. Everyone knows I blew it. They're all looking at me. They're saying I blew it. I was hopeless. And I said, oh, come on, you're not that important. So I kind of felt for the person, but I was like, come on. And this is the delusion of self, isn't it? It's a wicked thing.
Something you said earlier, I just wanted to clarify. You said that you're talking to somebody at the wedding and about enlightenment as a goal, and the person was talking about living in the moment. And I'm sure you didn't mean it that way, but my sense is that enlightenment as a goal keeps you always in the future, in a reward-oriented way of being, then you're actually missing the process of being in the present.
That's what she was coming up, you know, that's what she was saying. But I was talking about what we call chanda aspiration. Because I know darn well that my mind still can, you know, get caught up in annoyances and so on. So the aspiration is I read the texts, and the texts say, these are the things to be aware of, right? And if you pursue those and you're not aware of them, you're just going to get more lost. So the aspiration is a kind of sobriety about, yeah, this work, be careful here, be careful. But it's not an ego moving to the future. And that's the whole thing of goals. It's often misunderstood. It's kind of assumed that any goal is ego-oriented. But it doesn't. It can be also more like abandonment of that which is unskillful. So this is the irony that the realization cannot be in time. The nibbana cannot be in time. It's the deathless, it's the timeless. And so the awakening always has to be in the moment, and yet we're involved with purification. So in some chronological sense, I know that I'm a heck of a better person than I was 30 years ago. And yet that's only known as a thought right now.
Maybe it's a liberation in an awakened process of goal setting rather than our ego-based.
Yes, exactly. It's just reinforcing the awakened mind, because that's where it's at, period. So you have this kind of debate about instant enlightenment and gradual enlightenment, right? Mm-hmm. This kind of endless debate that goes on. Which is it? Well, it's neither, it's kind of instant enlightenment, but you do instant enlightenment for 30 years. Or 40 years or 40 lifetimes. So it's a very important question around time, because if my effort is to become something in the future, then that can't be it. So it's always like this opening the mind away from attachment, opening it.
You just reminded me of a metaphor, actually. It's like every daily practice, like putting a brick on this temple that you're building. So each practice is very important, because if you put a wrong brick, it can start the whole wall, you know, tilted. So it's like each practice is like a mini enlightenment in that sense.
Each moment of awakening is a moment of enlightenment, right?
You're building brick by brick.
Yeah.
The final enlightenment could be the final dawn or the final coronation or something.
Don't know yet.
Don't know yet.
I'm certain. I don't know. First floor, maybe. I don't know. But that's the you know, the religious life is one of mystery. Because desire only knows history. I can only desire what I remember. So desire mind is always looking for objects and histories. And that's why the Buddhist teachings about the abandonment of desire, the desire for objects. So there is this need to just let go, surrender, abandon. That whole language of religion, I love it. You know, it's a whole different language. Receptivity, it's a different language. And yet that does require effort. You know, it's got to kind of, you have to sort of make the intention or whatever. Very subtle. Anyone else? Yes?
Very interesting question. The Holy Ghost floating feeling that you had when you were on the ranch, how did you manage with it?
With the floating ghost feeling? It's great. How did you take it? I'm not sure you took it. Yeah, great. Well, I always kind of find myself quite humorous.
You feel like a distance, you have to go for a while because you could not sit.
No, I didn't make it a problem.
No,
I was just commenting on how my life creates social aloofness.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, it was a good result. Yeah, I mean, and if it was a problem, that's my discipline. So if I wanted to participate, then I disrobe. I could do that, but it didn't seem like worthwhile at the time. So like any discipline, any vehicle, you know, you have to give something up, don't you? Marriage, job, whatever. There has to be a huge component of letting go. So my life, there's a lot that I give up, but there's a lot I get. And I mean, I've worked that through. So, no, it was no problem. It was just more humorous. Just kind of, that's just a funny feeling. What else? Anyone else? Any?
I read somewhere in a novel, Holy Man telling the disciple that to live like a passenger in a train. And then I had an opportunity to travel around the year. And I thought about it while I was traveling. What it was like to be a passenger. And I found it for me to be impossible to live like a passenger. Because nothing is mine.
The what?
Nothing is mine. It's a passing show. Mm-hmm.
Yes and no. Because there's still social responsibility. And that's why it's always both. You know, there is that witnessing, but there's also the participation. It has to be both. You can't do one. I can't just sit in the monastery and hope everyone feeds me. You know, I have to clean the toilets, I have to answer the emails, I have to, you know, like anyone else. But within that, there's the witnessing consciousness, noticing stream of consciousness within that. Because we are social beings. You know, that's the misunderstanding of religion. There's a kind of assumption of some kind of bizarre passivity, which is actually impossible. Everyone has to participate. Everyone has to be a part of something. Even the hermit has to participate some way. So the participation in itself is, I think, what the passenger image or the witnessing image is pointing to is you're not trying to get everything out from the journey. You're trying to understand yourself within the journey. Right? So in the movement of monastic life, I don't expect monastic life to make me happy. You know, I have to find that here. So when monastic life is discordant, I say, oh, this is what it feels like when it's discordant. And I watch my reactions and judgments. And this is what it feels like when it's harmonious. This is what it feels like when I feel inspired by it. This is what it feels like when I feel bored by it. That's the vehicle moving, and I'm witnessing through that. But if I thought the journey, you know, itself was somehow going to get me there, then what do I do when I feel bored with monastic life? When I get fed up with those damn monks talking all the time, or, you know, all of that that goes on, what would I do? Because I'd be done. But I just witness. I witness the sense of boredom, the sense of, you know, like when we have a Vesak, Ajahn Chah, that if 2,000, 3,000 people on a circumambulation with a full moon, candles lit with his great teacher, just stoned on religious kind of ecstasy. And then Ajahn Chah would give a 4-hour talk. You know, I want to strangle him. You know? So is life just one peak experience of ecstasy and religious enlightenment, or is it just ho-hum, la-di-da, ooh, great, you know? This is, so that's the vehicle going up and down, and there's the witnessing. And the more you're with that witnessing, that you discover is that which is beyond the fluctuations, beyond the dualities, beyond the polarities. But you have to participate. You know, you just have to. You have to get on the train. You have to, you know, get your ticket and whatever. All right. Shall we call it a day? Right. Thanks for your attention. Any announcements?
Our readings, if you are.